Okay, Kim, so why don't you tell us what you've been doing in Japan?
Okay, sure. Well, for the last couple of years, I've been traveling to Japan almost every month to run a 4-year homeopathy program. Basically, my wife and I were visiting. We were traveling in Korea and in Japan, and we were meeting with some of the schools there to give them some training on homeopathic software and just to meet with them in general. And I did some training for one of the schools called Hahnemann Academy, which has got a branch in Tokyo and one in Osaka. And they asked me if I would teach a weekend class for their students, and I said I'd be happy to. And so I did that, and then I left, and I thought that was essentially the end of it. But when I got back, I received a letter from the school saying that the teaching that I had done there had gone over very well, and the students were very pleased with it, and could I come back and basically prepare a whole new curriculum for their 4-year program and teach basically the brunt of the classes. So I basically agreed to do that, and there were a couple of reasons I thought that it would be a good idea for me to do this. I mean, obviously, I have a fairly busy schedule between my teaching engagements here in North America and my practice, but I felt it was an opportunity for me to really bring in a classical orientation to homeopathy, because in my travels around, I see that there's a lot of newer approaches that are being introduced to students, and a lot of times people don't get a really good foundation in the classical methodology in homeopathy. So I both wanted to give them that quality of information, you know, the teachings of people like Hahnemann and Lippe and Bossier and Bunninghausen, but also the classical method in education in general, which maybe we can talk a little bit about later. But that's, you know, a specific approach to education that is a little bit different than what we see in mainstream education or even what we see a lot of in the homeopathic community. So, yeah, and just to give you an idea, I mean, in terms of a classical approach, it's not to say that I don't teach some of the contemporary approaches. I actually do, Marnie, introduce the students to, you know, the works of people like Rajan Sankaran and Massimo Mangiafiore and Jan Scholten. So you might wonder, well, you know, that doesn't sound very classical. Those are more contemporary approaches. And I would say that what makes the teaching classical is that I don't tell them about the work of Sankaran and the work of Scholten and the work of Mangiafiore or the work of anybody for that matter. What I do is I go through those people's works and I make the students work through their cases and for themselves discover the value or lack thereof of any particular approach. And I think this is really essential, because if I just stand up in front of a group of people and I say, okay, here's what I've discovered, here's the truth of this, write this all down, here's the gospel according to Kim, and they write down all that information and then they study it for some future test and subsequently immediately forget that information, they've really learned nothing at all. They've just gathered a bunch of information, but they don't actually have any real knowledge. For you to have real knowledge, you actually have to go through a process in yourself where you rediscover whatever great insights were developed by a particular founder of a particular approach, or insights that are new that have never existed before that you discover on your own. But this is really what is necessary for there to be knowledge. It actually involves a process of going through an actual experiential process in relationship to the universe in such a way that you gain real knowledge. And this, I think, is very important from a classical point of view in terms of education, and especially so in homeopathy, because otherwise you just have a lot of opinions but no real inner knowledge. And I think this is something that's absolutely necessary if we're going to advance as a professional science and art.
So can you tell me who some of your greatest influences have been then in terms of the classical homeopathy?
Sure, sure. Well, obviously Hahnemann has been probably my first and foremost greatest influence, and the Organon by itself is something that can be read repeatedly. I oftentimes like to share the story of Adolf Lippe, who was considered by many people to have been the greatest homeopathic prescriber who ever lived. They called him the Ajax of homeopathy, like the Greek general. He would drive into battle and he would defeat all of his foes. And Lippe, you know, in 50 years of practice, one of the busiest practitioners in the Philadelphia area, in 50 years, he never lost a typhoid, cholera, or malaria case. And these are diseases which generally have 60 to 70% mortality rates, and yet here's a homeopathic practitioner who simply, in 50 years of very busy practice, never lost one patient with any of those diseases. And the reason I like to mention that is because Lippe read the Organon twice a year for 50 years, And after 50 years, this incredible practitioner, who was probably a better prescriber than Hahnemann, after 50 years of reading the Organon, he finally said, I'm now just beginning to fully understand the Organon. And that really gives you a sense of the genius and depth contained in that work, and that you really can't understand it the first time that you read such a piece of genius. You really have to have been practicing for a period of time. You need to really go back and review these various concepts and ideas as they actually present in a clinical situation. And only after having done that for, 10 years or even many multiple decades, do you really appreciate how brilliant that work is and how many questions are really answered in that book. I mean, it's almost anything you can think of, any question you might have or come up with will definitely be addressed in either the Organon or perhaps chronic diseases or some of Hahnemann's other associated writings. So for me, at least, Hahnemann is the founder. It's not to say he's infallible. Certainly he can make mistakes and errors. But in terms of his genius, there are very few people who are born on the planet who have that level or caliber of genius. You can count them on basically two hands. People like Einstein and Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz and Benjamin Franklin and Plato and Nicholas of Cusa. I mean, there's just really a handful of people who had that level and depth of genius. So for me, the Organon, chronic diseases, his other writings are the place to start. Certainly there are other great practitioners who followed him. People like Bunninghausen's writings are essential. Herring is an excellent writer, has contributed tremendously to our literature. Lippe, of course, is another great prescriber. Nash, Henry Clay Allen is my personal hero in homeopathy, unlike some of the other practitioners out there. He was always very, very civil. I mean, he never compromised on his principles, yet he always treated everybody with the greatest civility. And I think as a consequence of that, he was able to achieve a lot more than some of the other stalwart, more acerbic personalities in homeopathy. Certainly the old journals are of great influence to me, and I highly recommend these to my students, to anybody I come in contact with, because it's a documented record of the efficacy of homeopathy over a period of 150 years, and especially some of the better journals like the International Hahnemannian Association Transactions. Those are excellent. Those ran from 1881 through 1927, and it's essentially the discussions and dialogues of the greatest homeopaths of that period, and discussing various cases, talking about points of philosophy. It's just fascinating reading. Then, of course, you've got things like the Organon Journal. The Organon Journal is considered by many people who have been the greatest homeopathic journal ever written. It ran from 1878 through 1881. It was edited by Berridge, Skinner, Swippe, Lippe, and Swan, and it's just pure gold. I mean, I tell my students, you want to read something after the Organon, print out all 1,800 pages of the Organon Journal and read it from cover to cover. And then you've got many other good journals, like the Homeopathic Recorders, which ran through into the 1950s. You've got the Medical Advance Journal. Some of the issues, the Hahnemannian Monthlies are very excellent, as well as the Hahnemannian Advocates. And then even some of the lesser journals, like the American Institute of Homeopathy Transactions, although for the most part there's a lot of garbage in that journal, there's also some excellent material as well. Henry Clay Allen was associated with that publication for a period of time. So for me, these old documents, these old journals are invaluable. I use them a lot in the teaching that I do because, I certainly have cases from my own practice on various remedies, but, when you do a remedy like Senkris or Crotalus Cascavel, one of the snake remedies, you may only have one or two cases in your home practice. And from my point of view, to really understand a remedy, you have to see, 10, 20, 30 different cases of that remedy, so you can get a picture of that remedy, which is multifaceted. Remedies do not present only in one way, and the advantage of going through 10 or 15 or 20 cases of one individual remedy is that it gives you a perspective on that remedy that otherwise you wouldn't have if you had simply only been studying the Materia Medica. Now, there's no question that we can't substitute Materia Medica study for just simply studying cases. Constantine Herring was very clear on that issue in his article on the study of Materia Medica. We definitely need to study Materia Medica, but there is a huge advantage in addition to the Materia Medica study to going through a number of different cases just so that we can see the different ways that a remedy could present in different types of clinical situations. So certainly the old journals have been invaluable to me. In terms of contemporary practitioners, I studied with Dr. Paul Hirschke for many years. I actually practiced in his office for almost 2 years. He's certainly been a very big influence on me in terms of my understanding of Materia Medica. I think that his cycles and segments model is really brilliant in terms of furthering our understanding of the dynamic nature of the remedies and our patients. So maybe we can talk a little bit more about that in a little more detail later, but that's been a huge influence on me. Certainly, George Patulkas' Materia Medica Viva has been an invaluable work in my own life in terms of understanding of the remedies. I can attest to their absolute accuracy in terms of what you'll see in your own practice. I can't tell you how many times I've read a remedy in his Materia Medica Viva and seen almost exactly the same thing in my own practice. So that's been a huge influence for me. And then there's many other practitioners and teachers, you know, people like Farouk Master. Dr. Will Taylor has had a big influence on me in certain areas of homeopathy. Luke DeShepper has certainly influenced my thinking on posology, the use of the 4th, 5th, and 6th editions of the Organon and the various posology methods associated with that. So, you know, I can honestly say that there have been many different people. I've had the good fortune to study and practice with many different people over the last 22 years. And, I can say honestly I've gained a lot from each one of them.
So with all these influences and insight, why did you decide to offer a class on the snake remedies?
Well, you know, the snake remedies are an interesting group of remedies in that we've only got approximately 21 total snake remedies in our Materia Medica. There's over 2,700 different species of snake. So for the most part, they're not particularly well represented in our literature. You know, you've got 21 and there's over 2,700 possible snake species that exist in nature. Plus, the ones that we do have any significant amount of information for is really only a handful. You know, we know a lot about lachesis. We know a little bit about Crotalus horridus. You know, we know a little bit about nausea, elaps, Crotalus cascavella, vipera. I mean, we know even less about those. And then there are remedies like, you know, dendroaspis and taipan and seras that really we have very little information. There are some exciting new provings that have been conducted and a beginning and a place to start. But I would say in general, the snake remedies are as a grouping are fairly underrepresented. And also remember the adage that the best, most powerful poisons make the best remedies. And snake venoms being usually hemotoxic and neurotoxic are going to very oftentimes be poisonous and therefore will be fit into the category of substances which will usually make good remedies. Also, remember that lachesis, which was the first of the snake remedies that was proven by Constantine Herring when he was down in Suriname in South America, that was originally proved in 1828. I believe the next snake remedy that was proven was about 10 years later, which was Crotalus horridus. And that was not even in itself a complete proving. So really for quite a while, probably a few decades actually, the only snake remedy which we really had that had any reasonable type of proving associated with it was lachesis mutis. And as a result of that, there's probably a good chance that a lot of people who needed perhaps another snake remedy received lachesis as being the only snake remedy available. And probably that snake remedy, lachesis, probably moved those cases forward in many situations, and therefore the symptoms that got resolved or improved got attributed to lachesis. So you could imagine that lachesis is probably one of those remedies that's overly well represented in both our repertory and our Materia Medica, because for a long period of time it was the only snake venom that we had. Probably people who needed other snake remedies, you know, maybe like Crotalus horridus or Crotalus cascavella, since those were not yet available, would have received lachesis. Lachesis was probably close enough to move a lot of those cases forward, and the symptoms that got altered were added under lachesis, creating a situation where lachesis is particularly well represented. And I think one of our jobs really is making that differentiation between lachesis and some of the other snake remedies. And this is something whenever you're going to be studying snake remedies, you're going to want to look at lachesis compared to the other snake remedies, in that we know a lot about lachesis, and we're going to want to be able to distinguish between the one that we have a lot of information for and those that we are less familiar with.
Well, you also taught a class on acid remedies as well as classes on remedies within various botanical groupings, such as the Solanaceae and the Umbelliferae families. So why do you teach Materia Medica in this way, and then do you prescribe using groupings such as these?
Okay, that's a good question. Well, I mean, the guy in the old-time homeopaths who taught remedies in botanical groupings or taxonomical groupings or zoological groupings was Ernest Farrington. And he basically would go through, you know, the Solanaceae, as you mentioned, or Umbelliferae, or the acid remedies, or, you know, the halogens, or any of a grouping of substances. Now, that's different than prescribing according to groupings. Okay, one is you take a grouping and you decide to study it as a grouping. The other is that in the course of your case-taking, you decide that instead of looking for an individual remedy, you're going to look for a grouping. And these are really two separate things. The study of a grouping doesn't mean that you prescribe according to a grouping. No, I do the former. I oftentimes will study remedies in groupings because sometimes remedies within a particular grouping will share certain characteristics. And just in terms of helping to remember those remedies, it's useful to study them against each other. The human mind works in such a way that you cannot memorize lists of information. The best way to learn something is to take something that you're trying to learn and compare it to something you already know. And I'll give you an example of this. If I describe, for example, a patient who is very restless, who is running around, you know, right after midnight, wanting to sip small amounts of tea, very anxious, worried about death, with exhaustion and a black discharge and a black tongue. So if you took all that together and you combine it, some of you on the call might be thinking, oh, that sounds like he's describing arsenicum. And up until this point, actually, that's correct. I am describing arsenicum. But if I now told you that the patient was very warm-blooded and wanted to throw their covers off, that would go against arsenicum. And then that would become a description of the remedy cicale. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this particular example is because this example works well in terms of understanding how the human mind remembers things. It will be much easier for you to remember cicale as the remedy which shared all of those arsenicum symptoms, the anxiousness, the restlessness, the black tongue, the debility, the sipping small water. It has all of those things that are arsenicum. The only difference is instead of being chilly and wanting to be covered up, cicale is a very warm-blooded remedy and wants to be uncovered. So here you can see an example of a remedy that shares many similarities to arsenicum, and that difference is what you tend to helps you to remember the two remedies. And this is always true when we're studying Materia Medica. We always want to compare new remedies with existing remedies. So this is especially useful when we're studying a group like the snake remedies, because the snake remedies as a grouping are going to share a lot of similarities. Now, that doesn't mean that they're all going to be the same. It doesn't mean that they're all going to be loquacious, or they're all going to be left-sided, or they're all going to be forsaken. They won't all share any single quality, but you will see similarities. You will see, for example, that forsakenness is a quality that runs through a lot of different snake remedies. Loquacity, although they don't all have it, many of them do. Left-sidedness is common to many of the snake remedies. So the advantage is we can see how they're similar and we can see how they're different. And especially with the snake remedies, not because so much they're within the same zoological grouping, but because the part that we prove, the venom, is going to have similar hemotoxic and neurotoxic effects on their prey. Consequently, we could imagine that they will have similar medicinal properties with some differences. When we're looking at other groupings like Solanaceas or Compositaes or Umbelliferae, in some of those remedies within a grouping, we may see similarities, but we may also see differences. For example, if you take Solanacea and you look at Belladonna and Stramonium and Hyoscyamus, which are all examples of Solanaceas, we can see that those three remedies share many similarities. They all have rages, they all have violence, they all have dilated pupils, they all have fear of the dark and fear of dogs and fear of water. And so we can see there's many similarities. But if we did some other Solanaceas, like Capsicum or Tabacum or Dulcamara, then those similarities wouldn't be as obvious. And I think that the reason this is the case is that the evolutionary or phylogenetic or botanical relationship is only one determinant of the quality of a plant. Other determinants would be simply the environment in which that plant lives and the chemicals it has to produce in response to the stresses of that particular environment. So, two different solanaceas may have very similar or very different chemical properties based on the environment in which they live. And so because of that, I would argue that you could study remedies from a particular grouping, like a solanacea or primulaceae or the acids. You could study them as such, and that might be fine. I think when you get to the point of trying to prescribe them as a grouping, then you can run into particular problems because sometimes you could have plants within the same botanical grouping which may have very different medicinal properties, or you could even have a situation where you have two plants which are not related to each other phylogenetically in terms of their evolutionary relationship. They're not related at all, but they have similar chemical properties because they were in environmental circumstances that were similar and which forced them to produce those chemicals in response. So there is, just to review, there's a difference between studying substances as groupings and studying them to try to prescribe them as a grouping. They're really entirely different things. I'm really a Hanumani prescriber, which means that when I prescribe based on the totality of the characteristic symptoms of the case, and I try to find an individual remedy that matches that totality of characteristic symptoms. Having said that, knowing remedies in relationship to each other and studying them in that way is very useful, and sometimes studying them within a particular grouping is useful. But remember, just because the remedies are within the similar grouping doesn't mean that those are the only remedies that need to be studied. For example, when we're studying a remedy like Vipera or Vipera berus, we aren't only going to compare that with Lachesis and Crotalus iridis and Elaps, which are remedies that do share many similarities. We're also going to compare it with remedies like Hamamelis and Pulsatilla, because actually Hamamelis and Pulsatilla are very similar to Vipera. And if you really want to understand Vipera, you have to study it in the context of not just other snake remedies, but even other remedies which are not snake remedies. And I think this is really what we see in practice. If you repertorize a case, you're not going to just see snake remedies at the top. You're going to see all kinds of different remedies. And when you're trying to figure out what to give, it's not going to only be from within one particular grouping. It might be, you might even be trying to decide whether you're going to give a mineral remedy, a plant remedy, or an animal remedy in a particular case. So that's something actually I would like to talk about in more detail during the course of the call. It's a very interesting subject, and I think there's value, again, in studying the remedies in groupings, but I do not prescribe them that way.
So what do you think about some of the newer approaches then who do really prescribe in that way?
Okay. It's interesting because there's a quote by Constantine Haring where he says, "It is the duty of all of us to go further in the theory and practice of homeopathy than Hahnemann has done." Okay, that's an interesting quote. Okay, he says, "It is the duty of all of us to go further in the theory and practice of homeopathy than Hahnemann has done." So basically, Haring, who's, one of the most important homeopaths after Hahnemann, Haring is advocating that we don't stop with Hahnemann, that we continue to develop and evolve homeopathy. And I think that makes a lot of sense. Any field of science, any field of inquiry or professional endeavor is going to require constant development and growth. We can't ever assume that we've discovered the ultimate and complete truth. That's not the way it works. We're constantly getting closer and closer to approximating the truth. And I think we can all safely say that homeopathy really is in its infancy. I mean, what we understand about homeopathy is relatively insignificant compared to what we'll know about it in 100 or 200 years. We really are at the very beginning of homeopathy, and there's a lot more for us to discover. So I think that, we definitely need to be exploring and looking at new approaches. Now, Haring does make this quote that we have to go beyond Hahnemann. He also says, however, if we don't rely on the strict inductive method of Hahnemann, we are lost and deserve to be mentioned only as a caricature in the history of medicine. So I'm going to repeat that again. He says, if we don't rely on the strict inductive method of Hahnemann, we are lost and deserve to be mentioned only as a caricature in the history of medicine. Now, you might think that those two quotes are in conflict with each other, one that says it's a duty of all of us to go further in the theory and practice of homeopathy than Hahnemann has done, and then the second quote, which says if we don't rely on the strict inductive method of Hahnemann, we are lost and deserve to be mentioned only as a caricature in the history of medicine. From my perspective, in my mind at least, those two statements are not in conflict with each other, because what remains constant in Hahnemann's teachings and in his ideas from the very, you know, first edition of the Organon, even going all the way back to his first announcement of the law of similars in his 1796 article called Essays on a New Principle, even going all the way back to that 1796 date, the one thing that remains constant with Hahnemann is that he uses a scientific approach, a scientific epistemology. And he develops his system, his art, his science of homeopathy, but that epistemology stays the same. In other words, he never starts exploring alchemy or black magic or any of the other possible ways of deriving knowledge that existed in Hahnemann's time. He uses a very scientific Platonic approach to the way that he derives his knowledge of his ideas within homeopathy, and also even his knowledge of Materia Medica. If you think about the way the Materia Medica is developed, basically, we derive our knowledge, according to Hahnemann's perspective, from two approaches, which is one is provings, and the other one is clinical practice. In both of those situations, you've got the law of similars, which you're verifying through an experiment, either in the context of a proving or giving a remedy in a clinical situation. Either way, you're basically fulfilling the basic fundamental principles of the scientific method, in that you're conducting experiments to further your understanding of a universal principle of nature. And this is what makes homeopathy scientific, really, is that it's not arbitrary. The law of similars is like law of gravity. It's like when Kepler discovered the universal laws of planetary motion, which was really the discovery of gravity, or when Johann Sebastian Bach developed, you know, the well-tempered system of polyphonic music. These weren't arbitrary discoveries. These were basically discoveries of universal principles of nature. The law of similars should be seen in exactly the same light. This is what makes homeopathy a science, is the discovery of a principle of nature. And all renaissances always begin with the discovery of universal principles of nature. So when you're talking about homeopathy, you're talking about a universal renaissance science, something which has the potential to save hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people on the planet. We, unfortunately, are in a precarious moment in the history of the planet right now, and we could see, as a result of that danger that we face, we might see things like epidemics or pandemics break out on the planet. We will be in a position to address that, just because homeopathy, being a universal science, will be able to, as it's shown in the past, effectively deal with these epidemic or pandemic situations. Does that answer your question, Marnie?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit to Materia Medica. You're well known for your approach to Materia Medica and teaching. So can you tell us a little bit how you do approach your Materia Medica?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, first of all, repetition is absolutely essential. You know, there's so much information on these remedies that you need to do a lot of repetition. The basic model that I use for studying remedies is the model that was developed by Constantine Herring in an article called The Study of Materia Medica, which describes his approach called the diagnostic approach. And this is the approach that all the old-time homeopaths use that allow them really to master the remedies. And it's an excellent approach. It's basically an approach where you study remedies in relationship to other remedies, the idea being that when you actually get down to analyzing a case, that's essentially what you're doing. You know, you've got the top 10 or 15 remedies that came up in your repertorization, and now your objective is to take those top remedies and compare them against each other to determine which one covers the totality of the characteristic symptoms of the case the best. So if you've already adapted yourself, if you're acclimated to studying remedies in relationship to each other already, it makes it that much easier for you to do case analysis. So that's a very important piece of it. Basically, it starts by going through the remedies and identifying which organ systems that remedy has a strong affinity for. And this is oftentimes disregarded in the study of remedies, but it's really an essential component, because We really need to know. Every remedy has different organ and tissue affinities, and you want to know what these are. And the reason this is important is because not every remedy could necessarily cure Parkinson's disease or multiple sclerosis or heart disease, because it wouldn't necessarily have an affinity for that organ system or tissues, and therefore would not have the ability to bring about a curative response in those areas. So the organ and tissue affinities is the first thing that we go through. Then we look at the various sensations that exist in the different organ and tissue systems, and it won't be the same. Sometimes you'll have a tearing sensation in one organ system and a throbbing sensation in another, so you have to learn that. Then you go through and you figure out what the modalities of the different organ systems and tissues are. Again, these may be different. For example, we mentioned arsenicum earlier. Arsenicum is generally chilly, better heat, but their head symptoms are warm, better cold. So there we can see an opposite modality. So you go through and then you'd look at all the modalities. Then you would go through and you'd look at the mental symptoms, and you would correlate those mental symptoms with the physical symptoms. So, for example, you know, if you saw on the mental plane a lot of cramping, like, for example, we might see in the remedy cuprum, a lot of emotional cramping where they tend to be tattletales, and they're kind of always telling on other people, and everything's got to be following the rules, and everything's got to be right, and, you know, they're the goody-two-shoes that complain about other students in the class. So they've got this kind of cramped mental-emotional personality. And then on the physical level, we also see cramping. We see it in the muscles. We see it in the respiratory system with a very spasmodic asthma. We see it in the cramping of the intestinal tract. So we see this idea of cramping running through cuprum on the physical, mental, and emotional levels. It runs through on all of them. And Herring recognized that this is the case in our remedies. So what you basically want to do is you want to identify how there are similarities. And when you're doing this, what you really want to do is you want to understand the remedy as a process, as a dynamic process, because in reality, your patients and the remedies are not a list of information. They're not a list of symptoms. If you try to study them as such, you will only have a very limited understanding of that remedy. It reminds me of aphorism 7 in the Organon, where Hahnemann says the outer symptoms reflecting, he uses the German word Wesen, which means gestalt or genius, and that's really what the picture is. It's something underneath those symptoms, but it's a dynamic process, and the objective of the class really is to develop what we call a thought object, an image in your mind of that remedy, so that when somebody comes in requiring that remedy, whether they have a toothache or urinary tract infection or they just had a death of a loved one, it doesn't matter, you'll be able to see that underlying pattern in all situations. And the only way to really do that is you can't tell somebody something directly. You have to do this metaphorically, because it's only through metaphor that you really gain any real knowledge of anything. Because real knowledge is an object, it's an idea that's created in your mind. And so the purpose of good material medic education should be to foster the development of that type of thought object in your mind, so that you really understand it beyond the simple words that describe that remedy state. So this is where I incorporate a lot of the ideas of Dr. Paul Hirschkew, also a lot of the work of George Patulkas, in that they have been the two pioneers that have really described remedies as a dynamic process. And, of course, we'll learn the keynotes, we'll learn the physical affinities, all the important modalities, but more importantly than that, we'll actually understand the dynamic nature and process of the remedy as a living entity in time, so that it's alive for you. It's not simply a list of information, but it actually creates a real image, like a living person is a real image in your own mind. Now, when we do this, the way that I set up these classes, because I recognize that repetition is important, is ahead of each class, about a week prior to the class, what I'll do is I'll send out, you know, 15 to 20, maybe 25 cases of a particular remedy. The students then work on those cases for the week prior to the upcoming class. Then we go through those cases together. We discuss the cases. We talk about the remedies that are indicated. I provide repertorizations for all of the cases. Then we will discuss the materia medica of one of the snake remedies, maybe even two, depending on that particular class and how big a remedy it is. We'll discuss, go through that. Then I will send you the PowerPoints for you to review afterwards, and then we'll do a few more cases, again, to further instill the image of that remedy in somebody's mind. So by the end of doing this, you will have gone through anywhere between 15 to 25, maybe even 30 cases of each remedy, the PowerPoints, and you will have had an opportunity to work on the cases on your own. So in my experience, at least doing it in Japan, I found this to be very effective because by the end of the process, they've heard the description of the remedy from a three or four different perspectives. They've gone through the materia medica together, and for the most part, they remember what the important characteristics of the remedy, and they have a basic image of the remedy in their minds.
Well, can you describe a remedy using your approach to the materia medica?
Why don't I go ahead and describe, Paul Hirsky, who's been a big influence on me, wrote a book called on Stramonium, and he goes through a very thorough description of the remedy Stramonium. So why don't I just give you a description of that remedy, okay? But this is how I would describe all the remedies. I'll just give you Stramonium quickly. So Stramonium, for those of you who don't know, is a very common remedy in practice. We use it all the time, especially for children. It's one of the top three or four or five remedies that we'll see in our practice. And Stramonium is especially good for very, very fearful children who have very strong fears of all different types. And the image to really understand Stramonium is if you could imagine you're out in the woods and you're lost and it's completely dark and you heard on the radio before getting lost in the woods that in the nearby zoo there was an escape and all of the lions and the tigers and the bears have been released from the zoo and they're in the jungle and they're in the woods with you. You can't see anything. It's totally dark. You know there are these other animals out there with you and you're trying to get around and all at once you hear a little crackling sound and you're ch-ch-ch-ch. And now if you close your eyes and you try to put yourself in that scenario, that's one of the fundamental feelings of the remedy Stramonium, is feeling of being alone in the wilderness, in the dark. There's something threatening out there. There's something dangerous. You can't see what it is. It's about to get you. You hear some noises. And so as a response of that situation, you overreact. Now, you can overreact physically, or you could overreact mentally, emotionally. If you overreact physically, you could start vomiting. You could have excessive perspiration. You could have diarrhea. You could have a type of stammering. Stramonium is very well known for this very violent stammering, where and it's really loud and very intense. So you might have something like that. Or you might have an emotional, physical reaction where you start to lunge out with your legs and your hands because you think there's something out there, and you start to scream, and you start to yell, and you start to attack, and you start to fight and bite and scratch. And this is the violent component of Stramonium, which basically is coming out of a state of fear. They're afraid, and then in response to that fear, they overreact, and in their overreaction, they can become extremely, extremely violent. Now, prior to this violent stage, of course, the other thing they can do is they can be very clingy. So Stramonium can look very much like Boreata carbonica because it can have these strong fears like Boreata carbonica. It can have the clingy nature like Boreata carbonica. And you might say, wow, Stramonium and Boreata carbonica, similar remedies. But those two aspects of Boreata carbonica and Stramonium are almost identical. The difference is that in Stramonium, the person will have a tendency towards violence and aggression and anger, which we will not see in Boreata carbonica, which tends to be very withdrawn, inward, inhibited, shy, and you won't see that strong violent component emerge. So in Stramonium, what you'll see is this kind of eruption, either physically, mentally, emotionally, some type of violent overreaction, the clinginess, the violent clinginess, and then eventually they exert so much energy that they overreact, and now they have to close a certain part of them off because they've expended so much energy. So now what will happen is Stramonium will try to shut themselves down because they've expended so much energy in response to their initial fears and frights. And so they kind of shut themselves down, and they close their body down. And you can see this in terms of the constipation and the inability to urinate, in the sensation that if a part of them is dead, they can even have things like blindness or a feeling like part of the leg or the arm is dead. There's all these sensations where there's a numbness or deadness in stramonium. They even have a very characteristic symptom where normal pains that should be very strong are not experienced as being painful. Again, all of this exemplifying the dead component of the stramonium picture. So now you've got this dead component. They've shut a piece of themselves off. You've got this dead component, but another part of them still wants to be alive. And so you've got this kind of battle between the part of them that feels dead and the part that wants to be alive. And you can see this in all the various types of dualities that exist in stramonium. You see, it's a very dual remedy. It's dual remedy as anacardium is. They have all kinds of, you know, confusion of identity, sense of duality. One very interesting symptom is a delusion that half of them is alive and half of them is buried and dead. And this is a perfect delusion which describes the fundamental conflict or issue in the remedy stramonium, which, of course, is this issue between being alive and being dead. And there's this constant battle or war that goes on between these two components of the remedy. And it creates tremendous confusion, indecision, capriciousness. All kinds of different things emerge from this state. And then from this state of confusion, duality, again, erupts and emerges these fears. So just in a kind of a nutshell, that's one way to describe a remedy, this in this case being the remedy stramonium. And you could basically, describing in this way, you could get all of the symptoms of stramonium, you know, whether they're physical symptoms or mental symptoms or emotional symptoms, it doesn't really matter. You can get all of them to fit into these various segments or ideas that represent the process or cycle to the remedy stramonium.
Do you have a case example of stramonium?
I do. I'd have to look it up.
Oh, okay.
Can I give you another one that I can have off the top of my head?
Sure.
Okay. I have a good one, which is... And I'll tell you where this has helped me. Like, you know, if you just read the older literature, like if you, and which is all excellent. I mean, not to put any of it down. Like, if you read Hahnemann's Materia Medica Pura and Herring's Guiding Symptoms and Timothy Field Allen's Encyclopedia Pura Materia Medica and Henry Clay Allen's Keynotes and Characters, those are all great books. All the information in there is reliable. You can bank on it. You can count on it. You know, these guys never made things up. They were really excellent practitioners. But they do not have as complete or deep an understanding of the remedies as some of the more contemporary practitioners have brought up. And so this is where this understanding of a remedy from a dynamic point of view is very useful, because sometimes you simply cannot see the remedy based on the older description in the old literature. I have, for example, a case of Asarum europaeum, a wild ginger, where if you read George Vitolkis's description of Asarum, it's clear. You can see it right away. But if you went back and you looked at the old literature, you simply would never prescribe Asarum europaeum, and therefore you would never prescribe it even in circumstances where it's indicated. And so I think it's useful to include some of these newer ideas in terms of homeopathy. So this was a case of a little boy who... had projectile vomiting. Projectile vomiting, green diarrhea, lots of stomach discomfort, very serious-looking baby. And basically the mother brought the child in, and, you know, it was just a lot of physical symptoms. And, you know, if you repertorize the case, you come up with any of a number of, you know, five or six different remedies. And, you know, any of them were possible good choices, but none of them were, like, where you get that gut-wrenching feeling and, you know, you're just sure it's the right remedy. I just didn't have that feeling. So I kept asking the mother of the child anything else. Basically, she said she couldn't think of anything else. So then as she's leaving and putting the baby in her, you know, in the backpack and about to walk out my door, I say, is there anything else you can think of? And she says, you know, maybe this isn't important, but... my son Charles didn't seem to connect with me as early on as other babies seem to connect with their mothers. And as soon as she said that, immediately I knew that it was a case of the remedy Athusa synapium, which is also known as fool's parsley. It's an umbelliferae. And it's a very important remedy for projectile vomiting. But the reason that I knew it was a case of Ethusa synapium is that this inability to connect is a fundamental segment or idea that runs through the Ethusa patients. It's a very interesting remedy. It was a remedy that was known for a long period of time, is useful in the treatment of cholera, very violent manifestations of cholera. It was also useful in certain types of convulsions, and it was well known for babies with projectile vomiting. Silica and probably Ethusa synapium were the two most common remedies in the treatment of projectile vomiting in infants. And George Vitolkis, when he was treating J. Krishnamurti, discovered the process of Ethusa, and one of the important components was this inability to connect. What he basically discovered was that the Ethusa patient was one who wanted to connect with other people but was unable to do so. And because he was unable to connect with other people, he would connect to animals, or he would get involved in political causes or things like that. Because of his inability to connect to human beings, he tried to sublimate this desire for connection in another area. And so this would be the people who would, like, you know, collect, you know, 10 dogs and 12 cats and 50 gerbils and 4 cows and a pig, and all those animals would be living in the home with the patient. And that might be one of the characteristics pointing to Ethusa. So there's this inability to connect, the desire to connect, this unresolved conflict between wanting to connect and not being able to do so, which then erupts out of the patient when they're sleeping. So they're consequently afraid to go to sleep, because if they go to sleep, these unresolved conflicts will erupt out of them. When they finally do go to sleep, they will have all kinds of cathartic reactions like vomiting and diarrhea, seizures, shrieking, all kinds of things that will come out. And then after that, they will go into a state of exhaustion. And then in that state of exhaustion, again, the need or desire to connect. So I knew that that desire to connect was an important component, important idea within the cycle or process of the Ethusa patients. And if I had simply been going based on old literature, old material medical, with a list of information, I never would have recognized Ethusa. And it was a great case, because I gave Ethusa and the child immediately, within, you know, 5 minutes, was asleep and woke up 24 hours later asymptomatic. So, you know, you can see that having these types of images in your mind is very useful in practice, because you can recognize cases that otherwise are difficult to discover the correct remedy for.
Well, we only have about 10 minutes left on the call, so why don't you give us a taste of the upcoming snake course that you'll be teaching?
Like, what are the remedies or something? I don't want to do too much, but let me just give you a little bit of a rundown, and then maybe some people could ask questions. But, like, for example, Vipera, you know, Vipera berus is just an incredible remedy. And, it's a remedy we use a lot. It's very similar to Lachesis in many respects, but it has some distinguishing features which really differentiate it. It has the bleeding that you see in Lachesis. So you see a lot of bleeding. You see perspiration, urination, vomiting. There'll be some type of release or discharge in Vipera. And that will usually be followed by weakness, prostration, exhaustion, okay? So you have some type of discharge in the form of bleeding, perspiration, urination, vomiting, and then a type of exhaustion will follow that. And then after that exhaustion, the patient will try to close up to protect their energy. So there'll be kind of this closed up or stuck feeling. And then this is very important. From that closed up or stuck feeling, they'll start to swell. You'll get edema. You get dropsy. Swelling, swelling, swelling. And then the swelling become inflamed, causing tenderness and pain. So this is common to a lot of the snake remedies, where you have this tendency towards release, towards bleeding, vomiting, perspiration, urination, things like that. One of the things about Vipera is it will tend to especially affect the nose, the gums, the bladder, the uterus. These are areas. It can also have a headache, which is ameliorated by urination, like you might see in Ignatia or Gelsimium. Again, the idea is that you've got this constant pressure, 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 and then some type of discharge, either perspiration or vomiting or something, will release that feeling of being filled up. Okay, so the bleeding, the vomiting, the perspiration, they can go on and on and on until they begin to aggravate that patient. Okay, and then you'll see the weakness, you'll see excessive bleeding, you'll see, like you would see in a lot of the other snake remedies, the black, dark, thin blood, like you would see in Elaps, for example. You would see it also in the Menzies, where the blood will be dark and clotted. Okay, so you'll see all of those types of things. And this is also a remedy we think of in injuries as well. So you could see that same type of thing in an injury where the area will turn black and blue, and usually the skin will be very mottled, like you would see in pulsatilla, for example. The top layer of the skin will tend to come off. There'll be lots of ulceration and pus, and then things like vomiting. Anyway, I could go on and on and on about it, but maybe that gives you just a little bit of a sense of just a few of the important characteristics. The thing about Vipera is that it's very, very similar to Lachesis in many ways. And so, just like the other snake remedies, when you're studying Vipera, you know, you learn certain keynote things, like, you know, the very important keynote of aggravated when they hang their limbs down, okay? And that's a big keynote, and everybody needs to remember that. But you also need to look at the more subtle differentiating features of, you know, how you would recognize Vipera versus Lachesis, you know? So, for example, they're both going to be very competitive. They both tend to have delirium from sepsis. They both have a forsaken feeling. They both have increased ambition. They both have inarticulate, incoherent speech. So these are very important common features, okay, that you'll find between all of them. And so what you need to do now is differentiate. What, you know, how do you find Vipera? Well, you know, the Vipera, when they can't fulfill their ambition, they give up, okay? They turn gloomy, okay, when they can't achieve their goals. Whereas Lachesis just doesn't give up. They become more industrious. They become more active. So you'll see there's a big difference. Vipera and Lachesis are both ambitious. In Vipera, they give up more easily than Lachesis does. Lachesis becomes highly industrious, you know. Both remedies, for example, can seem distracted, right? Vipera, it's more that they're absorbed, whereas Lachesis, they tend to be more absent-minded. Vipera tends to be indifferent, okay? They give up very easily. They tend to be indifferent to all external things, whereas Lachesis, on the other hand, tends to be very sensitive to all external things. Both of them have a forsaken feeling, okay, and even feelings of hatred and revenge. But with Lachesis, you're going to see it's going to be much more tied into their ego, okay? They can't stand any type of contradiction because their egos are so big that nothing is allowed to interfere with their supreme ego. So you'll see that much stronger in Vipera. Also, Lachesis is going to have much more sexuality than you'll see in Vipera. You'll see a lot of nymphomania, homosexuality, also the religious affections, which is a very big, strong component that's tied up to sexuality and the religious aspects, which are very strong for Lachesis, are almost entirely lacking in Vipera. So you see there's these type of things. Both are important liver remedies, although Vipera will tend to be more indicated for cirrhosis of the liver, whereas Lachesis will be more for alcohol poisoning and poisoning by heavy metals. Both have ulcers, gangrene. Anyway, you know, what I would basically do is show you where they're similar and where they're different, and also give you the actual dynamic process, and then go through a number of cases where it cements in your mind the picture of what we've just discussed, so that you really can see that exact same image, that exact same picture in a clinical context.
Great. Well, I'm sure we'll learn a lot more on your course.
Yeah.
So, besides the upcoming snake course, can you just tell us, as our last question, what your plans for the future are, and then we'll open up for a couple questions.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, basically I'm just teaching and seeing patients and going back to Japan on the 25th of November. And, yeah, basically, you know, I'm still trying to complete the development of a 4-year homeopathy program for my class in Japan. And more than anything, I'm excited about taking the best in classical education, you know, the advances by Wilhelm von Humboldt in Germany in the early 19th century, the contributions that people like Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz made to education, and even going all the way back to the Platonic Academy in Greece, in Athens, you know, the idea of a Socratic dialogue approach to education, one where I don't simply give out information, but help the student to develop the skills and qualities and capabilities in themselves to be able to study on their own and to really be able to develop a deep understanding of these remedies so that they can ultimately achieve greater success in their practice.
Great. intriguing and exciting. So I'm going to go ahead and see if we can get a couple questions in.
Sure.
Does anyone have any questions for Kim?
Would Kim make his teaching and course in Japan available to people here in the United States?
Well, you know, the only problem, Ahmed, is that I have a translator. So I speak, and then somebody translates into English, into Japanese, and then I speak. So it might not be that conducive to, an English-speaking person. But I think in the future I will probably do more materials, homeopathic training materials. But I think it might be a little bit difficult to take that just because it's got Japanese intermixed with it.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions?
Yes, Kim. I'm wondering, you had taught nutrition for many years prior to homeopathy. Can you give us a quick synopsis of how you got into homeopathy?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Well, you know, I was directing a nutrition program in Northern California at a place called Heartwood Institute, and I was also at the time studying transpersonal psychology, and I was looking for some other therapeutic modality to add into nutrition because, you know, if somebody's health problems are the result of poor nutrition, then you can help them with changing their diets, but, you know, if it's from some other cause, then, you know, you can do whatever you want with their diet, and it's not going to help them. And so I realized at a certain point I was looking for some other therapeutic modality to add to my knowledge of nutrition. And I was in the Arcata Co-op in Northern California, and there was a Maisie Panos' book, a little first aid book on homeopathy. And on the back was two quotes. One was by Mahatma Gandhi saying something to the effect that homeopathy is by far and away the most safest, most cost-effective, and effective system of medicine. That really caught my attention because I remember that Gandhi was somebody who basically rejected things from the West because he wanted the indigenous Indian people to be able to do their own, basically work on their own with pride on their own developments. And it caught my attention because here you've got Ayurvedic medicine, 6,000 years old, and here you got Gandhi advocating something from the West. So I thought there must be something pretty good about it if Gandhi, who, you know, was a proponent of all things Indian, is advocating something other than Ayurvedic medicine. And then there was also a quote by Roger Walsh, who's a transpersonal psychologist, and I was familiar with his works. And so, you know, I read those two quotes, and so I purchased that book, and I brought it home, and I read it, and it immediately resonated with me. I don't know what else to say, that, you know, the law of similars and everything they were describing made total sense to me. It was like something, I hadn't found it. It had found me, basically. And so I began to use remedies right away with my nutrition patients and started seeing fantastic results and just continued from there. And that was, you know, close to 22 years ago. And I have to say it's been, you know, one of the great revelations of my life, because to see homeopathy really work when somebody is seriously sick, and I'm not talking about functional problems, but people who've got multiple sclerosis or Parkinson's disease or, you know, or septicemia, and then you give this little pill and boom, everything goes away completely and they're asymptomatic. You know, you have in your hands something incredibly powerful. And for me, I would like to try to spread the word as much as I can about homeopathy and share whatever, you know, knowledge and wisdom I've gained in the last 22 years with as many people as I can. I mean, to me, this is the most profound system of medicine. It's a real gift from God. And it's, you know, it's my obligation to communicate that to as many people as I can.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Kim, I was wondering if your course about snakes, is it going to be like this by phone?
Yes, the way it works is it works by phone and by internet. So basically, we send you the cases the week before, work on the cases, then you call in on the phone line, and you hear, like you're hearing now, me lecturing. And also we have internet access where you can see the cases and the PowerPoints and any other visuals on the internet. So you can hear my voice, and you can also see whatever materials are being presented. Now, if it's the cases, you'll already have those because we email those to you ahead of time. If it's PowerPoints, we'll send those to you after the class. We don't send you the PowerPoints before the class because we don't want you to know what remedy is going to be discussed. in the following class.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome. And I believe we got CHC hours. Do you know anything about that, Marnie?
I think we're working on trying to get that done. Yeah, I know there's a lot of interest in that, which would be great. And that would, I think it's about a 20-hour course.
20 hours, yeah.
Yeah.
I would imagine we'll get it because, but anyway.
Yeah.
Any other questions that I can answer?
Hi, Kim. The snake class sounds, I mean, what you just said in such a snapshot really stimulated my interest in snakes far more than I ever thought.
Okay.
And which, you know, I love homeopathy, but are you teaching any more other classes, not just online, but are the more opportunities to learn from you, the better homeopath I'm sure many would be, not just myself. So where else are you teaching? Like in you know, seminars, workshops?
I teach it, mostly I teach at a lot of different schools. I teach in Japan. I teach at the Ontario College of Homeopathic Medicine, the Toronto School of Homeopathic Medicine. I was asked to teach at the Northwestern Academy in Minneapolis. I'm teaching at Bastyr University. I don't know, 15, 20 different schools in North America.
Wow.
Kim, when are you coming to Bridgeport soon?
I don't know off the top of my head, but if you ask Nikki, she can tell you, Ahmed.
Okay.
All right, everybody. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.